All right, we're good. So, brothers, welcome to the October edition of Friday with Friday. First thing I want to say is thank you so much, everybody, for being here. It is wonderful to see you all. I am incredibly pleased to be able to host a Friday with Friday with one of my very own chapter brothers from back in the day. So I'm going to start with a little intro that I have. So brothers, I would like to introduce Brother Steve Courtright, Stephen Courtright, initiated into the Beta Iota chapter at Albion College in 2001. Brother Courtright is currently recovering from a 15-year career as a music teacher, during some of which he dabbled in province leadership and province 35. Hopefully we'll see Brother Zaft later tonight. After years of serving as an officer in his local teachers union, he jumped over to professional labor representation work in August of 2020, and now fights for the right of public employees on a daily basis. Now he never wakes up panicking about sub plans. He does get joy out of helping people solve small but significant problems, and has oddly become comfortable counseling people to quit their jobs. Based in Juneau, Alaska, Brother Courtright has two brilliant children and a growing menagerie of pets. The title of his presentation is S is for Solidarity, a very brief history of labor unions and the labor movement in the USA. Brothers, please help me give a warm welcome to Brother Stephen Courtright.
Thank you for that, Dave. That was a very great, a lovely dramatic reading of the bio that I sent you. And yeah, when we're talking about solving problems, big and small, I spend a lot of time dealing with those things. And today was just another one of those fun days, solving some problems that are pretty significant for people, but not really things I can discuss at the moment. So let's go ahead and just jump right in. I'll share my screen here. And should be good. So yeah, as Dave said, S is for solidarity, not playing on the acrostic at all with that. A very brief history. And when I say very brief, what I mean is I would be happy to ramble about this for hours at a time. I'm going to try to keep it shorter than hours. I am a recovering educator. I'm happy to have people interrupt with questions. If you want to throw them in the chat, if you want to just unmute and pop in, that's great. Digressions and rabbit holes, rabbit trails are tons of fun. So it felt important to me before jumping right into what's it like in the United States to set a little bit of the scene and talk about what there was historically. So let's see. Oh, did I share the, okay. Oh, yeah, I put an extra slide in here. I forgot about that. So what do? I'm a field representative for APEA. The Alaska Public Employees Association. I work with, this is a statewide association that represents 24 individual local unions. The ones that I work most closely with are the supervisory unit, which is 2,100 members, and Confidential Employees Association, which is the only HR union that we know of at the state, for in a state in the country. Just under 200 members there. My daily life depends on what happens when the phone rings. I might be helping somebody understand their contract better. I might be helping to negotiate a new individual right for somebody who needs something. Or I might be representing somebody in a disciplinary hearing that's coming up in just a couple hours. And I enjoy all of it. It's great being able to feel like I'm on the side of the good guys and fighting for the rights of people who need their help. I am a former local union president for a teachers union. When we talk about me being in Juneau, oh, I have a phone call coming in, but I'm going to ignore because I'm talking to you guys. I'm in Juneau, which is right over here. It's the capital of Alaska. We are the only state capital in the country that is not connected by road to the rest of the country. So you have to fly or boat in. Before that, I lived here in Sitka, also in Southeast Alaska. About 100 miles between those two spaces. Southeast Alaska is the same size as Florida or New England, depending on how you think of it. So Alaska is a big, big place. I was a teachers union president when I was in Sitka, and I was vice president before that, and got started basically when I had a union rep who stood up and back down my boss and pulled my boss that they couldn't do what they wanted to do to me. And I realized, wow, there really is power in having people who can do this work and who understand their rights. So some of the historical antecedents to the modern labor movement, the big place that all of it started was with labor guilds. And this goes all the way back to antiquity. We're talking thousands of years back. There have been guilds all around the world. The most well-known organized ones come from Europe, where basically we have people who are skilled craftspeople who train each other. They train the next generation through apprenticeship programs. You can work your way up through from an apprentice through a journeyman up to a master. And it is an avenue for education before public education was a thing. Because these bodies were unified, they actually could pull off some early professional standards and essentially certification. You couldn't be a bricklayer if you weren't trained by the masons. You couldn't be a carpenter if you weren't part of the carpenters union, or carpenters guild, I should say. So it was sort of a proto version of what you see with the modern professional unions, such as or professional or associations, such as the Bar Association, or in the medical world, where you have professionals who determine the standards to be in their own field. But it started with laborers, which is kind of cool. They did have an early version of what we consider collective bargaining now, because they standardized their rates. If you wanted to have a mason doing work, that person would be working from generally the rates that were applicable in the area. And then, of course, you know, they would gather together at their guild halls, and it was a social opportunity. This probably sounds familiar to some things that you know of, both in the fraternal world and then also in the world of unions, if you know unions at all. Masons are probably one of the most famous of those guilds. The Freemasons, the modern Freemasons, evolved from a profession, one of those professional trades guilds. Has no relevance whatsoever to Sinfonia. We have no connection in any way to what the Masons have done. So let's not even bother talking about that, although I do find it interesting to consider that it's a social group that started as a labor organization. And I mean, there have been presidents. George Washington was a Mason. Their insignia is all over all kinds of stuff. So it cracks open this door of potential in my mind of where an organization such as ours potentially could go were we to embrace it. Okay, Industrial Revolution. This is a slide where I let you guys look at things while I talk. So most of you are probably aware from high school that the Industrial Revolution happened largely in the early 1800s. Yes, this is a Garrity thing. I don't know what this thing's called. It's a mangler. It mangles body parts. It's the end of agrarianism. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, most people lived in relatively rural locations. Communities were smaller. Even cities were relatively small. And most people lived relatively close to the land, with the exception of a small number of skilled tradespeople. The guild system that was supported by that had reduced relevance, though, as mass production took over. All of a sudden, you didn't have to have the great skill to work with iron that a blacksmith would have, because it's being churned out of a factory where everybody has just enough skill to operate the machine in front of them. So having an 8-year apprenticeship is much less important at this point. It also led to poor working conditions, no more rights for workers. Basically, management controlled everything. The owners were in complete control. People were working long hours. There were very few labor laws regarding the number of hours you could work in a day, the number of days you could work in a week. There were no age restrictions in most workplaces. And it was a very dangerous place to work. Horrible, disfiguring things were done to people on a regular basis. And you'd have entire families that would move from the country to the city to go work in a factory together. Pretty garbage. So the Industrial Revolution led to robber barons. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this term, but the robber barons were basically your, this is going to sound really weird, but imagine a world in which, with few restrictions, wealthy industrialists are able to build their wealth to the point where they can pretty much do whatever they want to do. They control the laws, they control the legislatures, they're above prosecution in the courts, and they pretty much can do whatever they want to do to their workers. And they have so much money that they can start doing massive public works projects just because they feel like it, undertaking wildly expensive endeavors that they think will make humanity better because they have the wherewithal to do so. There are absolutely no modern analogs for that, so we shouldn't even consider that. But you're probably noticing on this list of names, you got Rockefeller, Carnegie, Mellon, Hearst, JP Morgan. Every one of these names still exists in our world today. These are people who planted big seeds because they were able to get so much money. They were horrible humans to their workers, though. Though they may have been phenomenal philanthropists. What you see on the screen is a contemporary illustration of Standard Oil. I don't know how well you can see it, but it is Standard Oil depicted as an octopus that is controlling pretty much all of the US government with its power coming from the oil fields and the refineries. There are what appear to be journalists clutched in one tentacle while they also are controlling, reaching over the seas and wrapping around the ports because they were everywhere. They were in control of everything. There was pretty much no check on them. We got better in 1897 with the Sherman Antitrust Act, but still, they had the money that they could do what they wanted to do, and they didn't have a lot of pushback. Probably mistitled this. Shouldn't have said company towns, because that's the next slide. So, company towns. When you've got companies that have so much power, they will centralize themselves and they will set up company towns where they can do what they want to do while they're doing their business. Very common in mining, especially since mines tended to be in and tend still to be in rural locations. If you work on the oil fields today in North Dakota or Alaska, you're not commuting to and from town. You're staying in a dormitory on site that's paid for by the company. Now, these days they tend to pay for more of that, and that's part of your employee compensation is that you get pay while you're there. But it's still a thing that these are rural locations where the lodging and the food and all of that is provided by the company. In case anybody didn't hear, Amazon has actually started talking about bringing back company towns. By the way, feel free to hop in if anybody has questions, but
Actually, I was going to
yes.
ask about exactly that because I had heard about this, and the take that I've heard on this is that the fact that this might be a thing again should terrify everybody. Is that your official stance as well?
Has anybody heard of Tennessee Ernie Ford? Or the song 16 Tons?
Duh.
Yeah, so okay, that's company towns for you right there. The company town is essentially a situation where you've got a means of production of some sort and they build a community at the means of production. Usually it's a mine, but it could be something else as well. In the company town, the homes are owned by the company, the store is owned by the company. If there's a church that they've built, it's owned by the company. If there's a school, it's owned by the company, and everybody who works in all those places is employed by the company. They charge extortionist prices at the company store, and they charge extortionist rents in the company housing. It's designed so that you will always be right on the verge of debt, so that your income goes right back in the pockets of the company, and you never get ahead enough that you can leave. At least that's how it was done in the 1880s to 1930s or so. Who knows what Amazon would do?
So pretty much it's a plantation.
Yeah, you're putting people into serfdom, essentially.
Real quick,
If
Stephen,
you
something I found relevant, and everybody should check this out. Everybody knows, hopefully by this point, that South Park has made it a point to make fun of just about everything that has ever existed ever. They do an episode specifically on Amazon, Amazon employees, Jeff Bezos, they do it all. The intro to the episode plays the song 16 Tons.
Oh, well done.
And now I'm thinking about the lyrics in my head and all of the things that you just said, and I'm kind of terrified at myself that I found that funny at some point. Into the chat, I just put a link to a YouTube video, which is about 15 minutes long. Check it out after the presentation, definitely. But it's Amazon workers reacting to that episode of South Park. In hindsight, I realize I shouldn't have laughed, but you can see some of them that are like shaking their heads, laughing, just on the verge of tears, being like, this is so accurate. This is terrible how accurate this is.
So for those who don't know 16 Tons, and if you don't feel inclined to look it up, the relevant lyrics are 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. You can't say the company towns didn't make good music, at least. By the way, this presentation is full of a whole bunch of things that are very, very worthy of Googling and looking into in greater detail. I could talk to you for an hour about the Battle of Blair Mountain, but we don't have that time. So please look it up on your own. This is all pretty fascinating stuff. It's designed essentially, Michael, as you observed, to keep people in a state of serfdom where they don't have the options. They are perpetually at the service of the company, perpetually in debt to the company. And if you cross the company, you now have nothing. You haven't saved up any savings, and they'll kick you out of your housing. So it's a way of really keeping people in line and keeping them from standing up for their rights. Despite that, people did frequently, and it would get incredibly violent. The Battle of Blair Mountain was coal miners in West Virginia and involved possibly the first aerial bombardment within the United States. They literally flew over these striking miners and dropped bombs on them. Battle of Harlan County was the inspiration for the song Which Side Are You On? Which, if you don't know that song, it's absolutely phenomenal. That was Kentucky, also coal mining, if I remember correctly. The Bisbee deportation was striking miners in Bisbee, Arizona. I believe they're mining for copper. And not only were they kicked out of Bisbee, they were literally rounded up, put into train cars, and shipped to New Mexico. At a time when New Mexico was a territory, and I believe Arizona had gotten statehood. So it was pretty extreme. There was also definitely a racial element there. If I remember the facts correctly, most of the people deported from Bisbee were people who had come in from Mexico to work at the mine there. One of the most notorious is the Ludlow Massacre. The Ludlow Massacre occurred in Colorado. And the picture that you see on the screen here is of one of the armored cars that was used during the Ludlow Massacre. 21 strikers and civilians died. And if you look in the back of this armored car, you might notice that there is a machine gun mounted there. Because, yes, they used a machine gun on strikers. So there were some patterns that we see. What in the world? Oh, thanks, Dave. Dave was trying to highlight. There were some patterns to these labor battles that we'd see in this time period, that 50-ish year period from the 1880s to 1930s. The striking workers tend to be supported by the community. These are their families, their friends. They go to church with these people. But that community support doesn't usually get them a lot because there are outside forces brought in. Every single one of those labor battles that I mentioned on the first page, on the previous page, the first step was bringing the sheriff in. And the sheriff, every single time without fail, sided with the management, with the owners, with the company. Which makes sense when you consider that sheriffs, though they are law enforcement, are also elected, which, when they need to run for election, leads to great corruption. They also would tend to bring in what were known as detective agencies. These detectives probably would be better known as mercenaries. The Pinkertons still exist. You've probably heard of them. They're pretty famous. The Pinkerton detectives were they built this reputation of being sort of like the private army version of the U.S. Marshals, where they could go anywhere and they'd always get their man kind of deal. And they really specialized in taking down labor strikes. The Baldwin Felts agency was also a pretty well-regarded one at the time, if you were, at least if you were from the company side. The Pinkertons still exist. They have been absorbed into a Swedish security agency, but they still do provide investigative services, security services, and I think they do VIP protection as well. Believe it or not, the National Guard and the U.S. Army were also called in that case where the Bisbee deportation took place. I believe the sheriff started the deportation, the National Guard continued it, and then it was eventually determined through Supreme Court cases that there was really nothing that anybody could do about it, which I think is probably wrong. Another pattern is that there's usually extreme violence employed at this time. They are killing people. They are maiming people because they want to make it absolutely clear that you don't come up against the company. The strikers are also not afraid to employ lethal methods, and they will use guerrilla tactics at this time, but usually the violence is more overwhelming from the employer simply because they have the resources. They might not have the manpower, but they have the money resources that they can pay for the Pinkertons or the National Guard or whatever it might be. Another Steve, fun little...
Sorry, we got a question coming in from the chat from Brother Smith. Do the Pinkertons still get involved in union busting?
To my knowledge, officially, no. There haven't been clashes quite like this in a while. Great question. Thank you. It tends to be more connected to this last point here about the press blackout, where management would... Sometimes they outright owned the newspapers, which... Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, folks. Amazon owns the news. And, you know, Disney is frequently caught up in labor disputes. Disney owns ABC. We're seeing a lot of these same patterns repeat. History might not repeat, but it rhymes, yeah? In just a moment, I need to cough. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of these things coming up again. When Amazon was trying to, the Bessemer plant was trying to unionize recently, Amazon didn't have to go in and beat people because they could instead have mandatory meetings where they could basically hold all the workers hostage and give them the company line. They were able to use their connections within the government and the media to present their message and to pull some shady tricks, which is why, fortunately, that's actually being revisited. They may have to hold that election again. But so far, most modern strikes don't get nearly as violent, but that's also because, and this is totally not in my presentation, so Ryan, thank you so much for going down this rabbit hole for me. Modern strikes are now heavily governed by the law, whereas in these days, most strikes were what we would call a wildcat strike now, where they were just going on strike to assert their rights. These days, those do happen. You may recall in the Red for Ed fights a couple of years ago, where all the West Virginia teachers walked out, every single county voted to strike. There were 50,000 Arizona educators who stormed the Capitol. Every one of those was an illegal strike. None of them had met their state's legal requirements to strike, but because they had so many people who stood up and said, we're not working, they were able to still get their demands met because taking legal action against all of them was just too much. Thank you for that question. I'm not going to follow that rabbit hole where I was just tempted to go. All right, let's move ahead here. Come on. There we go. at the same time that you've got all this happening in the company towns with the robber barons and all that, there's a lot of organizing going on. We're coming out of this period of agrarianism through the Industrial Revolution, and there are these new political things starting to happen. This radical idea that people should profit from their own labor instead of just enriching the bosses leads to the growth of socialism and communism, which today, in fairness, both have a pretty bad brand in this country. I know that maybe not on this chat with these folks, but in this country, they have a pretty bad brand. But if you go back 100 years ago, they didn't have a bad brand, and they were all about empowering the worker. They were about taking the person who was at the bottom of the pyramid and giving them control over what they were doing. So this was a huge deal. There were many, many unions started. A lot of them were local. You know, think like fraternities, how you have the local fraternities, and then occasionally they start networking up and building up into something bigger. That's kind of how it worked out then as well. Dave, is there a question if I unmute?
That's actually a question for me. Can you speak to how this may have been influenced by the Great Depression? Because I see that that's right in where that would be.
Great Depression features. I don't have a whole lot to say on what that would mean for the memberships of unions. Although, of course, with all of them being employment based, a lot of unions did suffer during the Great Depression, just like everybody else did. So you do start seeing these alliances growing. The Knights of Labor were an early group that was incredibly dysfunctional. The first time that they tried to collect dues from all of their locals, they only got something like $500, which even back then was not much for an organization to operate under. They only had something like 15 delegates show up to their first convention. So they just were too disorganized, too loosely organized. But they grew into the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions. Some of you may know the name Samuel Gompers. He'd come over from the UK and brought this unionizing idea with him. And this was sort of an outgrowth of the Knights of Labor because the Knights of Labor were so dysfunctional. This federation would eventually grow into the American Federation of Labor, the AFL. So we're seeing this original growth starting to happen. One of the unique things about an organization like that is that previously you'd have maybe retail workers of a certain type who would organize a union and look out for each other. And then you'd have the steel workers over here, and you'd have the boiler makers over there, and they'd all have their own local union that cared only about themselves. But now that we start these federations happening, they realize that there's this broader brotherhood of labor. And by sticking together with each other, everybody does better. This is what you see currently in Europe. The labor movement in Europe is very much about operating like that. They call it sector bargaining, actually, where they still bargain by type of job class. And then if, say, McDonald's workers go on strike, not only is McDonald's on strike, but the printing company doesn't send them packages. And the agricultural workers aren't sending them beef and dairy. And the truckers aren't driving any of the products to the stores. So it's an absolute shutdown of the entire process. That's how it works in Europe today. Our solidarity isn't nearly as strong here, but that's the idea behind these federations, is that they can support each other. They can support each other during the picket and not cross the line. Hopefully none of you bought Frito-Lay a couple months ago or Nabisco last month for those reasons. Another union that starts growing at this time, the American Railroad Union. You may know the name Eugene Debs. If you've read any Kurt Vonnegut, he loves Eugene Debs and talks about him all the time. And also, you may know the name Jane Addams, famous for Hull House in Chicago. And she was one of the early organizers of the Women's Trade Union because, yes, women were working too. We so frequently erase them from our history, but they were there, and it was important to protect the things they were doing as well. All right, let's move on. So Dave, you talk about the Great Depression. Well, one of these two has everything to do with that. I'm sure most of you, I hope most of you have heard about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. It was a massive deal. Changed a lot of things for the better, and 146 lives for the very, very worse. 1911, Triangle Shirtwaist Company is a factory on the upper stories of a building in New York City. It's a garment producing factory. So they have scraps of fabric everywhere. The owners are tired of employees taking unauthorized breaks, so they lock all but one door, which is guarded by security. They also have poor ventilation, and most of the windows don't open because, again, they're concerned they don't want the workers trying to steal things by throwing them out the windows. So it's very locked down. It's very hot. It's an uncomfortably close working environment. The top couple of floors that are occupied by Triangle Shirtwaist are occupied by the management, and the production floors are beneath. A fire breaks out, and an immediate stampede happens for the exit, at which point the people working there realize the doors have been locked. This is an overwhelmingly female workforce. I think of those who died, 20 or 21 were men. Everybody else was a woman, and most of them were also very young. The managers were able to escape to the roof. A few of the workers were as well. But most of the workers, realizing they were trapped and realizing there was a fire coming up and nipping at them, either just simply didn't escape or leapt out of the windows. And there are contemporary accounts talking about the horror of the passersby as they saw the pile of bodies grow as one person fell on top of another and they all died. The fire department did get to the scene. It was a modern fire department. They had the newest equipment possible, but unfortunately their ladders didn't reach high enough. So though they had the equipment to fight a fire like this, they didn't have the equipment to fight a fire in a building this tall. This was not by far the first time that a tragedy had occurred in a manufacturing setting, but it was the first time that a tragedy had occurred in a manufacturing setting in the heart of worldwide media. It was in New York City. There were photos. There were eyewitness accounts. It made all the national newspapers that night. And it was a huge sensation. People noticed this. People cared about this. People were outraged by this. And it wasn't made any better by the fact that most of the victims were young women. Our society is a bit sexist, but sometimes it works out well for labor, I guess. One of the witnesses who saw this was Frances Perkins. And she immediately found her life mission at this point. She became a crusader for workers' rights and for safety in the workplace. She got laws passed in New York State that made it safer to be a worker, and eventually ended up working as a woman in the 1930s in the highest levels of the government in the state of New York. So just kudos right there to begin with. She was working closely with the then governor of New York, who was Francis Delano Roosevelt. You may know that name. And she so impressed him that when he went on to become president, he came to her and said, "Francis, I need you to come and be in charge of labor for me." And she would, but only under one condition, which was basically that he passed the New Deal. It was due to Frances Perkins and what she had learned going all the way back to Triangle Shirtwaist that to this day we have Social Security, Medicare, that the Civilian Conservation Corps was created, that the Hoover Dam exists, all of these things that were done through the New Deal. And frankly, the fact that, you know, we still talk about a Green New Deal today and talk about some of these same ideas came from Frances Perkins. So she's a true hero of the labor movement. And while she didn't necessarily start in unions, she absolutely helped make sure that we have an Occupational Safety and Hazards Administration, Safety and Health Administration, sorry. But yeah, when you go to work and OSHA is governing what you're doing and making sure that you are safe, that's because Triangle Shirtwaist happened 110 years ago.
So Stephen, we have a question from the chat.
Yeah.
And he included something after this. Brother Smith asks, how long did it take for the idea of a union to take influence Did it take decades during or after the Gilded Age for there to be a conscious idea of a union like the UAW to form? And then he said, actually, never mind. I think we'll get there on our own. LOL. So if the answer to this is coming in a future slide, you don't need to answer right now. Otherwise, that would be a great question to address.
So in the 1950s to 1970s, some of the big name unions, such as the UAW, begin to consolidate power. when we talk about what the modern idea of a chartered union, I actually saw earlier that this is the 75th anniversary of my union receiving its charter here in Alaska. I'm a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Oddly enough, we need representation when we work on the union side as well. So they were willing to take us on. So I get to learn all about the jobs open for linemen. And right now I'm trying to convince my kid to go do an electrical apprenticeship rather than going to college. Like, come on, you can make half wages without paying anything. And then when you're done, you make more money than I do without any debt. So anyhow, the idea of what is a union, the modern unions that we think of these days were mostly coming up in the 1880s or so, the earliest versions of them. And they're legally organized. They've got charters and all that stuff. There were definitely legal organizations that existed before that that did some of this work. But this is when we see what we think of as modern unions. And most of the modern, well, sorry, not most, but a lot of the modern unions that we know now started between the 1880s and 1930s in some form or other. Sort of our golden era, though, in the U.S. was the 50s to 70s. This post-war period where the baby boomers are baby booming and everything is just grand if you are a white man. These big name unions, you know, the UAW, the Teamsters, Steelworkers, the National Education Association becomes a big deal in the 50s and 60s. Screen Actors Guild and then eventually SAG-AFTRA become a big deal. You know, I think it's worthwhile to mention that since we do have enough performers in our brotherhood to merit that mention. In the 50s, the American Federation of Labor, which I'd mentioned before, unifies with the Congress of Industrial Organizations and become the AFL-CIO, and they get massive power. To this day, they're the most powerful union organization, the most powerful labor organization in the United States. You don't always have to agree with the work they do, but most union members are connected to them in some way. I'm a member of them and I represent members of them. We also see unions that come up working on more social justice and civil rights issues. Cesar Chavez comes out of Yuma, Arizona and starts the United Farm Workers. They're still incredibly important for the people who are doing farm labor work. Our migrant workers are a very vulnerable worker population and UFW is there for them. It's not only for them, but they are one of the very few groups in this country that's actually looking out for our migrant workers. SEIU, looking out for the service employees. A lot of them are in hotels and restaurants, but other places as well. They tend to be, I think they're the most powerful union in Nevada, actually, because Vegas is full of hotels. So they've got massive membership there. Unite Here is focused more on restaurants, and they're a newer organization than some of these others, but they're also doing some pretty great work. This is where we really see sort of a bifurcation into two different types of unions. We have the professional unions, which are more of your office or classroom setting. So the National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the federal and state unions that you see out there for all of the workers, ask me. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is a union like that. These people tend to be salaried. They tend to work year-round jobs and have predictable hours and benefits and all of those such things. We also see trade unions coming up, which look a lot more like your classic guilds. They tend to be more manual labor. They may have salary. They may have gig jobs, but they're a lot more focused on training people to be able to do the work. As I was saying, I'm trying to get my kid to go be an electrician because the IBEW will pay for the education and training. So we start seeing this split there. In general, your professional unions are a lot less activist, and your trade unions tend to be more activist, but that's not 100%. Also, in general, your professional unions tend to be a little bit more left-wing, and your trade unions tend to be a little bit more right-wing, but again, that's not absolute. And at the end of the day, as political forces, their real interest is about protecting labor, protecting workers. This is also the time period when you think of your classic, like the union boss that is controlling politicians or any of that. This is your time period where people are talking about that, where Hollywood portrays it that way. All right, so after that, we have Ronald Reagan's legacy. And I guess a couple of quick hits at the 1970s. We have over here on the left two very important court cases. 1975 is the Weingarten case. The Weingarten case establishes that if you are a union worker, you have right to representation if you're called into a meeting with your supervisor that could have negative impact on your work, whether you could lose your job, whether you can be demoted, whatever it might be. If it's a disciplinary hearing or if they might be changing your working conditions, you have a right to representation. That's a big deal. That's part of how I get my paycheck now. There's also the Abood decision, where the Supreme Court decided that if you were represented by a union contract, if you were in a workplace where you had a union contract and you were a public employee, this doesn't necessarily apply to private employers, but if you were a public employee, then you have to pay your fair share. So you didn't have to pay full dues, but you had to pay for your union representation. We'll come back to that soon. Ronald Reagan, former president of the Screen Actors Guild, turned out not to be a friend to labor. The most dramatic, I know, I'm sorry, Aaron, I should have warned you. Glad you were sitting down there. The most dramatic illustration of this came out during the air traffic control strike. I don't know how much you know of the history of it, but essentially the nation's air traffic controllers are trying to get a better contract. They went on strike. Reagan told them, come back to work or I'll fire you. And they said, no, there's no way he'll do that. There's no way he'll fire everybody. We're going to keep our strike going. And he indeed went ahead and fired all the air traffic controllers, blacklisted them from future employment, and brought in replacement workers. And this basically indicated that this combined with some big time corruption at a couple of the marquee unions, especially the UAW, where it was discovered that bosses within the union were collaborating with bosses at the companies to make each other very, very wealthy and keep themselves there. These combined put a very big black mark on unions, because up to that point, basically what unions had going for them were they're going to protect your job. They're going to give you security, which the air traffic control strike demonstrated that they couldn't do. And they were there for you, which the UAW corruption and a few other scandals revealed that they're not, at least not at that point. So this is massive black marks, and union membership plummeted as a result. There was an ongoing pattern, as you can see in this chart here. There's an ongoing pattern from the highs in the 50s. There's a steady decline that begins in the early 70s or so, and it accelerates in the 80s, where there are employer campaigns going to suppress the unions. There are weakened government protections. And then, of course, the public perception just drops off dramatically as well. Unions are blamed for all kinds of things, and they are absolutely sold as corrupt, wasting your money, just in it for the politics. You've probably heard all these narratives before. So, well, you know, why would anybody still be a member of a union when all that's the case? I mean, I still think there's value in it. We can still protect each other. We can still fight for our collective rights. We can still do better together. But I understand that there's a bit of an uphill climb. 2018, you may have heard of the Janus v. Ask Me decision. Mark Janus was a state employee in Illinois who didn't agree with having his fair share fees withdrawn under the Abood decision. So he challenged that and went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that because money is speech, as we all know from Citizens United, you cannot be compelled to speak by joining your union. You can't be compelled to pay fees if you don't want to. So since 2018, public sector unions, this is not true of private sector unions. So if you are at AT&T and they have a house, an in-house union, you don't have this option. You have to abide by the rules of that contract there. But since 2018, you have the option to be a freeloader. You can let the union negotiate a contract for you. The union has to represent you if you have a disciplinary hearing. I have absolutely represented non-members. And I kind of see it as it keeps us sharp a little bit. We have to prove to people that there's value in joining and being part of the team. But at the same time, we have exclusive access as a union rep. We have exclusive access to be the bargaining organization for that bargaining unit. So if I could go back before Janice, sure, I would. But if I every now and again have to represent somebody who's a non-member and do my best work for them, I'd rather do that than have all of the members lose the ability to have a union. So it's kind of the price we pay. I do like this graphic. It comes from the Economic Policy Institute. They have a lot of great tools there. It's just this nice little comparison. And as we all know, correlation does not imply causation, but there appears to be a pretty clear correlation between overall union membership and the amount of wealth and income going to the top 10%. It's an inverse relationship. They appear to be directly inversely related, or however you mathematicians say it. Not too much to say on that one. There are a lot of cool graphs out there that show things like this, but unfortunately, union membership is even lower now. We're down to about 10%. Public sector unions tend to be slightly higher in the workforce. It's something like 12 to 15% of public sector workers are unionized, and private sector is much lower. Hopefully that will change. So, as Jeb Bartlett would say, what's next? I think the big things are we got to know our rights. Whether you have a union or not, there are federal and state laws that govern your rights as a worker, and you should be aware of them. If you don't know what they are, feel free to look them up. You can call up somebody who works for a union like me and see if we can help you figure it out. Understand that you don't have to be in a union to be organized labor. A group of people who come together to bargain a contract, and you know, Aaron, you were talking about how you were going to stand up to your bosses and tell them what it would take for you to work the second shift. Well, it wouldn't be impossible for people within your workplace, with a union or not, to stand up and say, we're only going to work second shift if you give us a $5,000 bonus for it. And that could just be, you know, the second shift differential that everybody gets $5,000 more to work second shift. It can be a union. I think everybody should join one if you can, but you don't need a union to band together and fight for your rights. Absolutely talk about wages and benefits. This is the biggest tool that the employers have to keep workers from being empowered in the workplace. They don't let you know what everybody else is getting, and they tell you that you shouldn't talk about it. They tell you that you aren't allowed to talk about it. They shame you about it. Turns out you are allowed to talk about it. Federal law says you can talk about it, and they can't stop you. And the more you know, the better you do. And if you find out that the person next to you is making more money, then you should absolutely go and bargain for more. Good for them, by the way. But you should go and bargain for more. And if you find out the person next to you is making less, take them in and bargain for more for them too. If you are in the position to make job postings, normalize putting wages and collective bargaining agreements into the job posting. Again, this is a tool that's used to keep people from knowing what their rights are. A lot of people, you know, management will ask you when you apply for a job, they'll ask you what your desired salary is. And then they'll use that as a guide. I was reading a story just the other day of somebody who had made what she thought was decent money working in the Midwest. And she moved out to San Francisco and applied for a job. They asked her what she wanted. She thought she was asking for the moon by saying $120,000, and they gave it to her. She found out a couple of weeks later, everybody else in the office was making $150,000. So she thought she was asking for a big ask, and the company realized that they could get in $30,000 under their budget. So if you are in a position to post these things or to normalize it, we want to normalize that job postings should include the expected wages. And they should also, if there's a collective bargaining agreement, that should be on there. Let people see what they're signing up for. And then the final thing that I think we should all be doing is fighting for rights that are going to help other people. Some of us are parents. Actually, and is anybody else on this call? I'm a parent. maternity leave was a new idea 40, 50 years ago. But maternity leave eventually morphed into parental leave, which expanded the right beyond just the mother, just beyond that first person who could give birth to a child, to now both parents of a child, however they came to be a parent, are able to get leave. And that has expanded into family leave, which now means that it's available to people whether they've birthed a child or not. There are people who take family leave to care for their elders. There are people who take family leave to care for, you know, nieces, nephews, cousins, adopted children, whatever it might be. But the point is that if maternity leave hadn't happened in the first place, we wouldn't all have access to family leave now. So fight for the rights of others who look very different from you, perhaps, because it has a way of growing and coming back around. And with that, I think we've probably all seen Jed enough. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen. Thank you for listening in. I see a lot of comments in the chat. Let's see what's in there. Oh, Zaf, hey, how's it going?
Brother Courtright, I was just about to let you know that there is definitely at least one other parent in here. Our chapter brother
yeah, Kyle Kays now.
Is yep. here as well.
So, yeah, I'm happy to take any questions that may be out there.
I'd like to start with something, if I may. You very intentionally avoided, I believe I counted 74 different tangents that you wanted to go on during your presentation. I would appreciate it if, while the recording is still going on, you could mention a few of those things, just in case there are things that you think that people that are not as involved with unions as you are should look into.
Wow. You're asking me to remember anything I said, Dave.
I feel the same way after my class periods, but yeah.
Yeah, tangents just kind of happen along the way for me usually.
That's fair.
I would encourage people to look up the National Labor Relations Board. There's some interesting stuff there sometimes. Federal labor law in general is very misunderstood, largely because it's boring. And there's a lot of it. Like, for instance, you've probably heard a lot about HIPAA. Everybody's talking about HIPAA these days. Nobody knows how to spell it. But I actually took the time to read. Well, I tried to take the time to read HIPAA, and then I realized it was way too long. So then I just started scrolling through it, trying to find the relevant sections for the situation I was dealing with. And then I realized that HIPAA didn't even generate the rules that mattered. That came from a separate rule-creating document, the standards for that situation. So then I went and looked that up, and it was even longer. So people tend not to be aware of rights because it's just so burdensome to become aware. But yeah, I encourage folks to look at that kind of stuff. Look up your local labor history. There's all kinds of fascinating stuff out there. And the history of how some of these things came to be is wild. There's a lot of mistreatment, and frankly, the popular culture versions of things tend to be dramatic misrepresentations. Like, you go and read up on the Pinkertons, and there's all these talks about the heroic efforts of a couple of people, how the Pinkertons were one of the first companies to employ women on an equal basis with men, which is great. Let's not undersell that. That's a great thing. But they were using them because then the women could infiltrate these garment factories. and do some pretty shady things there. Which actually, okay, one of my favorite little unionizing anecdotes. Infiltration is great. There's an old school, it's now very illegal, and it was probably illegal then, but there's an old school tactic where you'd have a couple of unionizers who would move to a town at the same time without anybody knowing they were together. And one would come in and be the public face of the union and be organizing the workers and doing all that. And the other would come in and basically have the role of ingratiating themselves in with the bosses and getting to know all the people who liked the bosses. And then passing those names over to the other guy, who would then expose them as great union supporters so they'd get fired and could be replaced by union supporters. So I love that. You know, it's not like a judo move. We're going to use the management's awful tactics against them. They're going to fire anybody who supports the union. So everybody who hates the union is now getting fired. Yeah. Any of those old classic labor battle things, I think are absolutely worth looking into. The Battle of Blair Mountain, Battle of Harlan County. And then all the old labor songs. There's usually some rich stories there. And a lot of things that we see through a certain lens. You know, you talk about laughing at, you know, the 16-ton stuff. It's kind of a silly sounding song until you start understanding the actual history in it. And holy cow. I tend not to remember my notes so well, Dave. That's why I write them down.
Well, how about this? I realize this might be a big ask. I'd be asking for another hour of your time or so, but could you go back and rewatch the presentation as somebody who is watching yourself and then perhaps take some notes on it and let us know all of those tangents that were actively taking place as you were presenting? That would be really wonderful. Most definitely. Were there other questions, comments for Brother Courtright?
Not yet.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, I think
might pop up during later.
I think I have a question. Currently, the company that I work for, I'm non-unionized, but I work with plenty of union and non-union labor. How do I make sure, how do I make sure my rights are protected as labor, even though I'm non-union?
That's tricky. A good first place is to make sure that you know in detail your company's policies. Make sure you know your contract and your HR policies. I know a lot of people who have been in situations like that and were able to turn the HR policy right back on the person who was trying to use it against them. So that's probably your first strongest defense, is just to know what the rules are that you're playing by. Beyond that, it absolutely helps if you have a strong understanding of the laws that are applicable. There are labor attorneys who you can consult. That gets expensive, obviously. Depending on what the situation is, you may have a local union that would be happy to consult with you, and they might even be willing to organize with you. I would definitely always start by understanding the policy. Anything that you have signed that you will be beholden to is something that you should know thoroughly, which we're all bad about. I don't even know my own contract. It's sitting right here. And I can tell you the only time I've opened it in the past month was when I needed to know how much my per diem was. So we're all bad at this, but you should start by knowing your own rules that you have to play by.
That was actually something I put in the chat not too long ago. If you have a contract, get to know it.
Yeah.
Same advice that I give to chapter presidents regarding our national constitution and bylaws. These are the rules that we play by. Yes, it is a long read. You should still read it all.
Yeah, and it is actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, Dave. It's very much like that, in that whether they're good or bad, they're the rules we have.
Yep.
and we have to understand them and know how to use what we have. And maybe if I can fix them.
Indeed. I try to keep a copy of the 87-page contract that I have for my union on my desktop at all times and read it when I can.
So the biggest union that I work with has a 103-page contract. But they're also they're also very diverse and include everything from nurses to state troopers to, I don't know, captains in the Marine Highway System.
Well, very diverse indeed.
Yes.
Were there other questions or comments for Brother Courtright?
I did have one more question that I remember from the beginning, then I'll be good. But so there's a lot of jobs that have been created in the past 20 to 30 years when it comes to modern technologies and all that, that at least from what I've seen, haven't even really had a chance to unionize by any means, whether it's IT, developer work, anything like that. Do you see a shift for that happening in the future of like developers or specific like tech companies even starting to unionize?
I would love it if it were the case. And it has been a relatively prominent matter of in the right angles of the news, I guess. there are others in this chat who could speak about this if they'd like. But one of the largest tech companies in the country, which used to employ one of the people in this call, is Apple. And they are widely known for being not very labor friendly. And workers started talking to each other. They realized they had common cause. They realized there were things they needed to get fixed in the workplace. And they started advocating together to make that happen. Google's going through the same thing. Amazon's starting to go through the same thing. Starbucks is on the way to organizing. Anchor's on the way to organizing. Collective O Coffee was the first coffee chain to get it going. And the Starbucks people keep hitting them up now, trying to figure out how to do it. But we are seeing that people are realizing that when workers talk to each other, they can help each other get what they need. Even if they don't get a union out of it, they can still come together, talk to each other, fight for their rights. There are definitely unions that are actively working in that space, but it's one of the first rules of organizing a union is you don't talk about organizing a union, because as soon as management knows you're doing it, they're going to try to shut you down. So there's a lot of work that's going on, and it's hard to know who's doing what at the moment. But I guarantee, you know, when those Slack channels are working on Apple or Apple Slack, I can't English anymore, but when they're having those Slack conversations, I guarantee there are several unions that are keeping very close tabs on it and helping some of those people have those conversations. Here where I am, there's a local hospital consortium that's been buying up hospitals in Southeast Alaska. They've picked up two more in the past couple of years. They're on track to pick another one up next year and possibly another one a year or two after that. And they have no unions on board. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking we could put at least three unions in this workplace. But until people come to me and talk to me about it, it's hard to see what we can make happen. So yes, I think there is a future of unionizing here. I think people are, especially younger generation people, you know, those of you who are under 30 are definitely the ones who are realizing that there's a power there and you have a different sense of what society could and should be. Those of us who are more in like that 30 to 50 range, whatever generations you want to call it, have been more conditioned to just work with the system. And so we're not as good at that. Which is why so many of us have student loans, and instead of just defaulting on them, we're all going, can you forgive it, please? whereas, you know, younger generations are just like, I got nothing. What are you going to do? I'm just going to default. Yeah, my credit's garbage. So what? I wasn't going to buy a house anyways. And I think those are the folks who are the future of unionizing.
Excellent. Any other questions or comments for Brother Courtney?
Brother Angel?
Actually, yes. I'm going to show my cynicism here. I, at one point, worked for a human resource clearinghouse reporting agency. Basically, the WHAMI manager doesn't like me, call center. I took calls from all over the place, and I learned one thing. Never trust HR. Talk with your coworkers, find out how much, and don't ask, hey, dude, how much do you make? But be open, because if you're making $60,000 and the guy that just walked in the door is making $70,000, you're going to be pissed off because he doesn't know what he's doing. And yet, just be careful with HR because they're not there for you. If I'm wrong, correct me, please.
So I have the joy of working with, as I said, about a 200-person HR union. And that's such a, it's such a weird, beautiful space to be, but I get to know a lot of their inside mindset. Believe it or not, HR does believe that they are there to make life better for employees. However, their mission is to, it's commonly thought that they're there to help management do what management wants to do. That's also not true. They're there to minimize risk for the employer. They're the Jeff Sperry coming in and saying, hey, let's manage our risk. And if you are the employee who shows up to work without pants on one day, you have just created a lot of risk and you're going to get fired. If you are the employee who shows up and is drunk at work, you've just created a lot of risk and you're going to get fired. If you are the supervisor who berates all of your employees, you've just created a lot of risk and you are going to hopefully be fired. So that's the better lens to view HR through. If you can show them how something that's going on in the workplace is a problem that causes risk for the company, hopefully they don't decide to eliminate that risk by getting rid of you, but actually decide to fix the problem. But yeah, don't go in there thinking HR is your friend, because they're not. They're there to serve a specific role in the organization.
They are the warden for the company.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Thank you. Yeah, just for the guy, basically for Ryan, because you're the youngest one in here, don't trust them. They'll be your friend. They'll lie to you. They'll bring you donuts. And then when you accidentally cause a problem that keeps a problem going, chunk. And they don't care.
And free donuts on Friday and Taco Tuesday in the lunchroom are really no substitute for a wage raise.
Oh, but those donuts are so delicious. They're from Sublime. They're amazing. They're absolutely worth the $5 an hour raise.
Yeah, they might be a good bribe. They're great for getting a job done a little bit quicker. But if they're defaulting to we have a fun workplace or any of those kinds of, we take care of our people because we got a ping pong table. Okay. But am I going to be expected to work after 9 o'clock at night? What are my hours? What are my wages? How's your child care situation?
So don't fall for distractions is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. I work in tech. They put in a dartboard. I do tech support and they put in a dartboard with real darts. This was not a smart thing. Flying pointy things in management do not mix.
I am sensing the upturn that I was hoping for in the social aspect of the night. So I'm going to interject and say thank you one more time to Brother Courtright. This was an amazing presentation. I feel like I learned so many things. Let's show some appreciation to Brother Courtright one more time. Thank you so much. This was fantastic. And before we talk about Brother Angel and pointy things, I'm going to recommend that we stop recording.
Thank you all. I actually do have to sign off. I've got to go get dinner with my kids. I normally would stick around for the social, but great seeing all of you. And actually, I'm going to throw my personal email in here really quickly. If you have questions, if you have thoughts, if you want to know more about any of this stuff, please hit me up.
Be on every bathroom wall in a week.
I look forward to it.
Steven, great to see you.
Yeah, good seeing you as well.
Enjoy your dinner. If you're inclined to check back in after dinner is done, we may still be going.
If you're still going by the time that I'm able to make it back in, I'll be impressed. I've got a full evening.
I think we've hit 1 a.m. before Eastern time, so.
Yeah, it's going to be a little later than that before I'll be able to come back this way. But have a good night, y'all.
Have a great rest of your night, Stephen. Thank you again.
Bye.
And recording.